Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this hour of the Kids Zone here on their radio reading service. This is Mark Wiesner, and today I'm flying solo. My wife has been doing the job for the past couple of weeks, and now she's out of town, and so here I am. You've got me. We take ourselves to the book that Jan has been sharing with you called Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. It's a novel written by Mildred D. Taylor. It's a Newbery Honor book, and Jan says it's an interesting story so far, and I'm going to jump right back into it. So here we go. The Wallace store stood almost a half mile beyond Jefferson Davis on a triangular lot that faced the Soldiers Bridge crossroad. Once the Granger Plantation store, it had been run by the Wallaces for as long as I could remember, and most of the people within the 45-mile stretch between Smellings Creek and Strawberry shop there. The other three corners of the crossroads were forest land, black and dense. The store consisted of a small building with a gas pump in front and a storage house in back. Beyond the store, against the forest edge, were two gray clapboard houses and a small garden. But there were no fields. The Wallaces did not farm. Stacy and the other students were standing in the doorway of the store when Little Man, Christopher John, Claude, and I ran up. We squeezed through so we could see inside. A man we all knew was Caleb Wallace, stood behind the counter. A few other men sat around the stove playing checkers, and Jeremy's older brother, R.W., and Melvin, who had dropped out of school long ago, leaned sleepy-eyed against the counter, staring at us. "You all go on back to the back," said Caleb Wallace, "lessen you all wanted to buy something. Mr. Dewberry got the music going already." As we turned away from the entrance, Melvin Sims said, "Just look at all those little children come to dance," and the laughter of the men filled the room. Christopher John tugged at my arm. "I don't like this place, Cassie. Let's go on home." "We can't leave without Stacy," I said. Music beckoned from the storage room where Dewberry Wallace was placing round brown bottles on a small table as we crowded in. Aside from the table, there was no furniture in the room. Boxes lined the walls, and the center floor had been cleared for dancing. Several older couples from Great Faith were already engaged in movements I had never seen before. "What they doing?" asked Little Man. I shrugged. "I guess that's what they call dancing." "There we go," someone shouted at the back door. The storeroom slammed shut. Stacy turned quickly and sped to the back of the building. TJ was fleeing straight toward Soldier Road. Stacy tore across the Wallace yard and, leaping high like a forest fox, fell upon TJ, knocking him down. The two boys rolled towards the road, each trying to keep the other's back pinned to the ground. But then Stacy, who was stronger, gained the advantage, and TJ, finding that he could not budge him, cried, "Hey, wait a minute, man. Let me explain." Stacy did not let him finish. Jumping up, he pulled TJ up too and hit him squarely in the face. TJ staggered back, holding his eyes as if he were badly hurt, and Stacy momentarily let down his guard. At that moment, TJ rammed into Stacy, forcing the fight to the ground again. Little Man, Christopher John, and I, with the others, circled the fighters, chanting loudly as they rolled back and forth, punching at each other. All of us were so engrossed in the battle that no one saw a mule wagon halt on the road and a giant man step out. It wasn't until I realized that the shouting had stopped behind us that the girls and the boys beside me were falling back that I looked up. Mr. Morrison towered above us. He did not look at me, or Christopher John, or little man, although I knew he had seen us, but walked straight to the fighters and lifted a still-swinging Stacy off TJ. After a long, tense moment, he said to Stacy, "You and your sister and brothers, get on in that wagon." We walked through the non-silent crowd, Caleb, Dewberry Wallace standing on the front porch of the store with the Sims, stared at Mr. Morrison as we passed. But Mr. Morrison looked through them as if they were not there. Stacy sat in front of the wagon with Mr. Morrison. The rest of us climbed into the back. "Now we gonna get it," shuddered Christopher John. "I told you we all should have gone on home." Before Mr. Morrison took the reins, he handed Stacy a handkerchief in which to wrap his bruised right hand. But he did not say a word, and it wasn't until we had passed the crossroads leading to Great Faith that the silence was broken. "Mr. Morrison, you gonna tell Mama?" Stacy asked huskily. Mr. Morrison was very quiet as Jack the Mule clopped noisily along the dry road. "Seems I heard your mama tell you all not to go up to that Wallace store," he said at last. "Yes, sir," said Stacy, glancing nervously at Mr. Morrison. Then he blurted out, "But I had a good reason." "Ain't never no reason good enough to go disobey your mama." The boys and I looked woefully at each other, and my bottom stung from the awful thought of what mama's leather strap against it. "But Mr. Morrison," I cried anxiously, "TJ was hiding there 'cause he thought Stacy would have never come down there to get him. But Stacy had to go down there 'cause TJ was cheating and..." "Hush, Casey," Stacy ordered, turning sharply around. I faltered for only a moment before deciding that my bottom was more important than Stacy's code of honor, and Stacy had to take the blame for it, and Mama whipped him right in front of God and everybody. Once the truth had been disclosed, I waited with dry throat and nauseous stomach for Mr. Morrison to say something. When he did, all of us strained tensely forward. "I ain't going to tell her," he said quietly. Christopher John sighed with relief. "Ain't going to down there no more neither," he promised. Little man and I agreed, but Stacy stared long and hard at Mr. Morrison. "How come, Mr. Morrison," he asked, "how come you ain't going to tell Mama?" Mr. Morrison slowed Jack as we turned into the road leading home. "'Cause I'm leaving it up to you to tell her." "What?" we exclaimed together. "Sometimes a person's got to fight," he said slowly. "But that store ain't the place to be doing it. From what I hear, folks like them Wallaces got no respect at all for colored folks, and they just think it's funny when we fight each other. Your mama knowed them Wallaces ain't good folks. That's why she don't want you all down there. And you all owe it to her and yourselves to tell her. But I'm going to leave it up to you all to decide." Stacy nodded thoughtfully and wound the handkerchief tighter around his wounded hand. His face was not scarred, so if he could just figure out a way to explain the bruises on his hand to Mama without lying, he was in the clear. For Mr. Morrison had not said that he had to tell her. But for some reason I could not understand, he said, "All right, Mr. Morrison, I'll tell her." "Boy, you crazy," I cried as Christopher John and little man speedily came to the same conclusion. If he did not care about his own skin, he could at least consider ours. But He seemed not to hear us as his eyes met Mr. Morrison's, and the two of them smiled in subtle understanding, the distance between them fading. As we neared the house, Mr. Granger's Packard rolled from the dusty driveway. Mr. Morrison directed Jack to the side of the road until the big car had passed, then swung the wagon back into the road's center and up the drive. Big Ma was standing by the yard gate that led onto the drive, gazing across the road at the forest.
"Big Ma, what was Mr. Granger doing here?" Stacy asked, jumping from the wagon and going to her.
Little man, Christopher John, and I hopped down and followed him.
"Nothing,"
Big Ma replied absently, her eyes still on the forest. "Just worrying me about this land again."
"Oh," said Stacy,
his tone indicating that he considered the visit of no importance. Mr. Granger had always wanted the land. He turned and went to help Mr. Morrison. Little man and Christopher John went with him, but I remained by the gate with Big Ma.
"Big Ma," I said, "what Mr. Granger need more land for?"
"Don't need it," Big Ma said flatly. "Got more land now than he know what to do with."
"Well, what he want with ours then?"
"Just like to have it, that's all."
"Well, seems to me he's just being greedy. You ain't going to sell it to him, are you?"
Big Ma did not answer me. Instead, she pushed open the gate and walked down the drive across the road into the forest. I ran after her. We walked in silence down the narrow cow path, which wound through the old forest to the pond. As we neared the pond, the forest gaped open into a wide brown glade, man-made by the felling of many trees, some of them still in the ground. They had been cut during the summer after Mr. Anderson came from Strawberry with an offer to buy the trees. The offer was backed with a threat, and Big Ma was afraid. So Anderson's lumbermen came, chopping and sawing, destroying the fine old trees. Papa was away on the railroad then, but Mama sent Stacy for him. He returned and stopped the cutting, but not before many of the trees had already been fallen. Big Ma surveyed the clearing without a word, then stepping around the rotting trees, she made her way to the pond and sat down on one of them. I sat close beside her and waited for her to speak. After a while, she shook her head and said,
"I'm so glad your grandpa never had to see none of this. He dearly loved these here old trees. Him and me, we used to come down here almost every morning, or just before the sun was just about to set, and just sit and talk. He used to call this place his thinking spot, and he called that old pond there Caroline, after me." She smiled vaguely, but not at me.
"You know, I wasn't hardly 18 when Paul Edward married me and brung me here. He was older than me by about 8 years, and he was smart. Oh, my Lord, that was one smart man. He had himself a mind like a steel trap. Anything he had seen done, he could do it. He had done learned carpentry back in there, Macon, Georgia, where he was born. Born into slavery, he was, 2 years before freedom come, and him and his mama stayed on at that plantation after the fighting was finished. But then, when he got to be 14 and his mama died, he left that place and worked his way across here up to Vicksburg. That's where he met you, ain't it, Big Ma?" I asked, already knowing the answer. Big Ma nodded, smiling. "Sure was. He was carpentering up there, and my papa took me in with him to Vicksburg. We was tenant farming about 30 miles from there to see about getting a store-bought rocker for my mama. And there was old
Paul Edward, working in that furniture shop just as big. Had himself a good job, and that old job wasn't what he wanted. He wanted himself some land. Kept on and kept on talking about land, and then the place came up to sell. And he bought himself 200 acres from that Yankee, didn't he? Big Ma chuckled. That man went right on over to see Mr. Hollenbeck and said, "Mr. Hollenbeck, I understand you got land to sell, and I'd be interested in buying me about 200 acres if your price is right." Old Mr. Hollenbeck questioned him good about what he was going to get the money to pay for him. But Paul Edwards just said, "Don't seem to me it's your worry about how I'm going to get the money, just as long as you get paid your price." Did nothing scare that man. She beamed proudly, and Mr. Hollenbeck went on and let him have it. Of course, now he was just about as eager to sell this land as Paul was to buy. He had it for going on nearly 20 years. Bought it during Reconstruction from the Grangers, because they didn't have no money to pay their taxes. Not only didn't they have tax money, they didn't have no money at all. That war left them plumb broke. Their old Confederate money wasn't worth nothing, and both Northern and Southern soldiers had done ransacked their place. Them Grangers didn't have nothing, but they had their land, and they had to sell 2,000 acres of it to get money to pay them taxes and rebuild the rest of it, and that Yankee bought the whole 2,000. Then he turned around and tried to sell it back to him. Huh, Big Ma? Sure did, but not till 87, when your grandpa bought himself that 200 acres. As I hears it, that Yankee offered to sell all 2,000 acres back to Harlan Granger's daddy for lesser than the land was worth. But that old Fillmore Granger was just about as tight with a penny as anybody ever lived. He wouldn't buy it back. So Mr. Hollenbeck just let other folks know he was selling, and he didn't take long before he sold all of it, because it was some mighty fine land. Besides, your grandpa, a bunch of other small farmers, bought up 800 acres, and Mr. Jameson bought the rest. But that wasn't our Mr. Jameson, I supplied knowingly. That was his daddy. Charles Jameson was his name, Big Ma said. A fine old gentleman, too. He was a good neighbor, and he always treated us fair, just like his son. The Jamesons was what folks call Old South from up here in Vicksburg. And as I understand it, before the war they had as much money as anybody, and even after the war they managed better than some other folks because they had made themselves some Northern money. Anyway, old Mr. Jameson got into his mind that he wanted to farm, and he moved his family from Vicksburg down in here. Mr. Wade Jamison was about 88 years old then. But he didn't like the farm, I said. Oh, he liked it all right. Just wasn't never much had it, though. And after he went up north to law school and all, he just felt he ought to practice his law. Is that how come he sold Grandpa them other 200 acres? Sure is. And it might mighty good of him to do it, too. My Paul Edward had been eyeing that 200 acres ever since 1910, when he done paid off the bank for them first 200. But old Mr. Jameson didn't want to sell. About that same time, Harlan Granger come head of the Granger plantation, you know, him and Wade Jameson, about the same year's children, and he wanted to buy back every inch of land that used to belong to the Grangers. That man crazy about anything that was before the war, and he wanted his land to be every bit like it was then. Already had more than 4,000 acres, but he just itching to have back them other 2,000 his granddaddy sold. Got back 800 of them, too, from them other farmers that bought from Mr. Hollenbeck. But Grandpa
And old Mr. Jameson wasn't interested in selling, period. Was they, Big Ma? They didn't care how much money Mr. Granger offered them. I declared with an emphatic nod.
That's the truth of it all, agreed Big Ma. But when Mr. Jameson died in 1980, and Wade come head of the family, he sold those 200 acres to Paul Edward and the rest of his land to Harlan Granger, and moved his family into Strawberry.
He could have just as easily sold the full 2,000 acres to the Grangers and gotten more money, but he didn't. Until this day, Harlan Granger still holds it against him, because he didn't. The soft swish of falling leaves made Big Ma look up from the pond and at the trees again. Her lips curved into a tender smile, and she looked around thoughtfully.
You know, she said, I can still see my Paul Edwards' face the day Mr. Jameson sold him them 200 acres. He put his arms round me and looked out at his new piece of land. Then he said exactly the same thing he said when he grabbed himself the first 200 acres. Said, Pretty Caroline, how you'd like to work this fine piece of earth with me?
Sure did, and said the exact same thing. She grew quiet and rubbed the wrinkles down one hand as if to smooth them away. I gazed at the pond, glassy gray and calm, until she was ready to go on. I had learned that at times like these, it was better to just sit and wait than to go asking disrupting questions which might vex her.
So long ago now, she said, eventually in a voice that was almost a whisper, we worked real hard getting them crops sown, getting them reaped. We had us a time, but theirs was good times, too. We was young and strong when we started out, and we'd like to work. Neither one of us, I'm proud to say, never was lazy, and we didn't raise us no lazy children, neither. Had ourselves 6 fine children. Lost our girls when they were babies, though I suppose that's one of the reasons I love your sweet mama so much. But them boys grew strong, and all of them loved this place as much as Paul Edward and me. They go away, they always come back to it. Couldn't leave it. She shook her head and sighed. Then Mitchell, he got killed in the war, and Kevin got drowned. Her voice faded completely, and when she spoke again, it hardened, and there was a determined glint in her eyes. Now all the boys I got is my baby boys, your papa and your Uncle Hammer, and this place as much as theirs mine. They blood in this land, and hear that Harlan Granger always talking about buying it. He pestered Paul Edward to death about buying it. Now he's pestering me. She grumbled again. He don't know nothing about me or this land, but he thinks I'm going to sell it. She became silent again. A cold wind rose, biting through my jacket, and I shivered. Big Ma looked down at me for the first time.
You cold?
No, ma'am, I stuttered, but ready to leave the forest. Don't you be lying to me, girl, she snapped, putting out her hand. It's time we was going back to the house anyway. Your mama will be home soon. I took her hand, and together we left the Caroline. Despite our effort to persuade Stacy otherwise, when Mama came home, he confessed that he had been fighting TJ at the Wallace store, and that Mr. Morrison had stopped it. He stood awkwardly before her, disclosing only those things that which he could honorably mention. He said nothing of TJ's cheating, or that Christopher John, little man, and I had been with him, and when Mama asked him a question he could not answer honestly, he simply looked at his feet and refused to speak. The rest of us sat fidgeting nervously throughout the interview, and when Mama looked our way, we swiftly found somewhere else to rest our eyes. Finally, seeing that she had gotten all the information that was going to be get from Stacy, Mama turned to us. "I suppose you three went to the store too, huh?" But before any of us could squeak out an answer, she exclaimed, "That does it!" and began to pace the floor, her arms folded, her face cross. Although she scolded us severely, she did not whip us. We were sent to bed early, but we didn't consider that a punishment, and we doubted that Mama did either. How we had managed to escape a whipping we couldn't fathom until Saturday, when Mama woke us up before dawn and piled us into the wagon. Taking us southwest towards Smellings Creek, she said, "Where we're going, the man is very sick, and he doesn't look like other people. But I don't want you to be afraid or uncomfortable when you see him. Just be yourselves." We rode for almost 2 hours before turning onto a backwood trail. We were jarred and bounced over the rough road until we entered a clearing where a small weather-grayed house stood and fields stretched barren beyond it. As Mama pulled up the reins and ordered us down, the front door cracked warily open, but no one appeared. Then Mama said, "Good morning, Mrs. Berry. It's Mary Logan, David's wife." The door swung wide then, and an elderly woman, frail, toothless, stepped out. Her left arm hung crazily at her side as if it had been broken long ago, but had not mended properly. And as she walked with a limp, she smiled properly and widely, throwing her good arm around Mama and hugging her. "Land sakes, child, ain't you something?" she exclaimed. "Coming to see about these old bones? I just says to Sam, I says, 'Who you reckon coming to see old folks like us? These yo babies, ain't they? Lord Almighty, aren't they fine? Sure is.'" She hugged each of us and ushered us into the house. The interior was dark, lit only by the narrow slat of gray daylight allowed in by the open door. Stacy and I carried cans of milk and butter, and Christopher, John, and Little Man each had a jar of beef and a jar of crowder peas, which Mama and Big Mama had canned. Mrs. Berry took the food, her thanks intermingled with questions about Big Ma, Papa, and others. When she had put the food away, she pulled stools from the darkness and motioned us to sit down. Then she went to the blackest corner and said, "Daddy, who you suppose gonna done come to see us about us?" There was no recognizable answer, only an inhumane gestural wheezing. But Mrs. Berry seemed to accept it and went on, "Miss Logan and her babies. Ain't that something?" She took a sheet from the nearby table. "It's got's to cover him," she explained. "He can't hardly stand to have nothing touch him." When she was visible again, she picked up a candle stump and felt around a table for matches. "He can't speak no more. The fire burned him too bad. But he understands all right." Finding the matches, she lit the candle and turned once more to the corner. A still form lay there, staring at us with glittering eyes. The face had no nose, and the head no hair. The skin was scarred, burned, and the lips were wizened black, like charcoal. As a wheezing sound echoed from the opening that was a mouth, Mama said, "Say good morning to Mrs. Berry's husband, children." The boys and I stammered a greeting, then sat silently, trying not to stare at Mr. Berry during the hour that we remained in the small house. But Mama talked softly to both Mr. and Mrs. Berry, telling them news of the community as if Mr. Berry were as normal as anyone else. After we were on the main road again, having ridden in the thoughtful silence over the wooden trail, Mama said quietly, "The Wallaces did that, children. They poured kerosene over Mr. Berry and his nephews and lit them on fire.
One of the nephews died. The other one is just like Mr. Barry. She allowed this information to penetrate the silence, then went on. Everybody knows they did it, and the Wallses even laugh about it. But nothing was ever done. They're bad people, the Wallses. That's why I don't want you to ever go to their star again, for any reason. You understand? We nodded, unable to speak as we thought of a disfigured man lying in the darkness. On the way home, we stopped at the home of some of Mama's students, where families poured out of tenant shacks to greet us. At each farm, Mama spoke of the bad influence of the Wallses, of the smoking and drinking permitted at their store, and asked that the family's children not be allowed to go there. The people nodded and said she was right. She also spoke of finding another store to patronize, one where the proprietors were more concerned about the welfare of the community. But she did not speak directly of what the Wallses had done to the Barrys, for, as she explained later, that was something that wavered between the known and the unknown, and to mention it outright to anyone outside of those with whom you were closest was not wise. There were too many ears that listened for others beside themselves, and too many tongues that wagged to those they shouldn't. The people only nodded, and Mama left. When we reached the Turner farm, Moe's widowed father rubbed his stubbled chin and squinted across the room at Mama. "Ms. Logan," he said, "you know I feel the same way you do about them low-down Wallaces, but it ain't easy to just stop shopping there. They overcharges me, and I has to pay them the high interest. But I got credit there 'cause Mr. Monitor signs for me. Now you know most folks around here sharecropping on Montier, Granger, or Harrison land, and most of them just about got to shop at that wall store or up at the Mercantile in Strawberry, which is just about as bad. Can't no go no place else." Mama nodded solemnly, showing she understood. Then she said, "For the past year now, our family's been shopping down at Vicksburg. There are a number of stores down there, and we found several that are treat us well." "Vicksburg," Mr. Turner echoed, shaking his head. "Lord, Miss Logan, you ain't expecting me to go all the way to Vicksburg. That's an overnight journey in a wagon down there and back." Mama thought on that for a moment. "What if somebody would be willing to make the trip for you? Go all the way to Vicksburg and come back with what you need?" "Won't do no good," retorted Mr. Turner. "I got no cash money. Mr. Montier signs for me up at the Wallace store so I can get my tools, my mule, my seed, my fertilizer, my food, and what few clothes I need to keep my children from running plumb naked. When cotton picking time comes, he sells my cotton, takes half of it, pays my debt up that store, and my interest for they credit, then charges me 10% to 15% more as risk money for signing me in the first place. This year I earned me near $200 after Montier took his half of the crop money, but I ain't seen a penny of it. In fact, if I managed to come out even without owing that man nothing, I figured I've done a good year. Now, who way down in Vicksburg going to give a man like me credit?" Mama was very quiet and did not answer. "I sure sorry, Miss Logan. I'm going to keep my young'uns from up at that store, but I got to live. You all got it better than most folks around here because you all got your own place, and you all ain't got a kowtow to a lot of this stuff. But you got to understand, it ain't easy for sharecropping folks to do what you was asking." "Mr. Turner," Mama said in a whisper, "what if someone backed your signature? Would you shop up in Vicksburg then?" Mr. Turner looked at Mama strangely. "Now, who'd sign for me? If someone would you do it?"
Mr. Turner gazed into the fire, burning to a low ash, then got up and put another log on it, taking his time as he watched the fire shoot upward and suck in the log. Without turning around, he said, "When I was a wee little boy, I got burned real bad. It healed over, but I never forgot the pain of it. It's an awful way to die." Then, turning, he faced Mama. "Miss Logan, you find someone to sign for my credit, and I'll consider it deeply." After we left the Turners, Stacy asked, "Mama, who do you want to get to sign?" But Mama, her brow furrowed, did not reply. I started to repeat that question, but Stacy shook his head, and I settled back, wondering, then fell asleep. Chapter 5. The blue-black shine that had so nicely encircled TJ's left eye for over a week had almost now completely faded by the morning TJ hopped into the back of the wagon beside Stacy and snuggled in a corner not occupied by the butter, milk, and eggs Big Ma was taking to sell at the market in Strawberry. I sat up from beside Big Ma, still sandy-eyed, but not believing that I was actually going. The second Saturday of every month was market day in Strawberry, and for as far back as I could remember, the boys and I had been begging Big Ma to take us to it. Stacy had actually gone once, but Christopher John, little man, and I had always been flatly denied the experience. We had, in fact, been denied so often that our pestering now occurred more out of habit than from any real belief that we would be allowed to go. But this morning, while the world lay black, Big Ma called, "Cassie, get up, child, if you're going to go to town with me, and be quiet about it. You wake up Christopher John or little man, and I'll leave you here. I don't want them crying all over the place, 'cause they can't go." As Jackie swept the wagon into the gray road, Big Ma pulled tightly on the reins and grumbled, "Hold on, you Jack, hold on. I ain't got no time to putting up with you and TJ's foolishness." "TJ?" Stacy and I exclaimed later. He gone?" Big Ma didn't answer immediately. She was occupied in a test of wills with Jack. When hers had prevailed and Jack had settled into a moderate trot, she replied moodily, "Mr. Avery, come by after y'all was asleep last night, wanting TJ to go to Strawberry to do some shopping for a few things he couldn't get at the Wallace store. Lord, that's all I need with all the trouble about is for that child to talk me to death for 22 miles. But Big Ma didn't need to say any more, and she didn't. TJ was far from her favorite person, and it was quite obvious that Stacy and I owed our good fortune entirely to TJ's obnoxious personality. TJ, however, was surprisingly subdued when he settled into the wagon. I suppose that at 3:30 in the morning even TJ's mouth was tired. But by dawn, when the December sun was creeping warily upward, shooting pale streams of buff-colored light through the forest, he was fully awake and chattering like a cockatoo. His endless talk made me wish he had managed to wheedle his way so speedily back into Stacy's good graces, but Big Ma, her face furrowed in distant thought, did not rush him. He talked the rest of the way into Strawberry, announcing as we were arrived, "Well, children, open your eyes and take in Strawberry, Mississippi." "Is this it?" I cried, a gutting disappointment enveloping me as we entered a town. Strawberry was nothing like the tough, sprawling bigness I had envisioned. It was instead a sad, red place. As far as I could see, the only things modern about it were a paved road which cut through its center and fled northward, away from it, in a spindly row of electrical lines. Lining the road were stripes of red dirt, splotched with patches of brown grass and drying mud puddles, and beyond the dirt and the mud puddles, gloomy store buildings set set behind raised wooden sidewalks and sagging verandas.
"Shoot," I grumbled. "It sure ain't nothing to shout about."
"Hush up, Cassie," Big Ma said. "You too, TJ. Y'all in town now, and I expect y'all to act like it. Another hour, this place will be teeming with folks from all over the county, and I don't want no trouble." As the stores gave way to houses still sleeping, we turned onto a dirt road, which led past more shops and beyond to a wide field dotted with wooden stalls. Near the field entrance, several farm wagons and pickups were already parked, but Big Maul drove to the other side of the field, where only two wagons were stationed. Climbing from the wagon, she said, "Don't seem like too many folks ahead of us. In the summer, I'd have to come on Friday and spend the night to get a spot like this." She headed towards the back of the wagon. "Stacy, you and TJ stay up there a minute and push them milk cans over here so I can reach 'em." "Big Ma," I said, following her, "all them folks up there selling milk and eggs, too?"
"Not all, I reckon. Some of 'em got meats and vegetables, quilts and sewing and such. But I guess a good piece of 'em selling the same as us." I studied the wagons parked at the field entrance, then exclaimed, "Well, what the devil we doing back up here, then? Can't nobody see us?"
"You watch your mouth, girl."
Excuse me. "You watch your mouth, girl," warned Big Ma. Then, arranging the milk cans and baskets of eggs near the wagon's edge, she softened her voice and promised, "We'll do all right. I got me some regular customers, and they'll check to see if I'm here before they buy."
"Not back here they won't," I grumbled. Maybe Big Ma knew what she was doing, but it made absolutely no sense to me to be so far from the entrance. Most of the other farmers seemed to have the right idea, and I couldn't help but try to make her see the business sense in moving the wagon forward.
"Why don't we move our wagon up there with them other wagons, Big Ma? There's plenty of room, and we could sell more."
"Them white folk wagons, Cassie," Big Ma said gruffly, as if that explained everything. "Now, hush up and help me get this food out."
"Shoot," I mumbled, taking one of the buckets from Stacy. "By the time a body walks way back here, they'll have bunions on their soles and corns on their toes."
By noon, the crowd, which had covered the field during the early morning, had thinned noticeably, and wagons and trucks began to pack up and head for town. After we had eaten our cold lunch of oil sausages and cornbread, washed down with the clabber milk, we did the same. On the main street of Strawberry once more, Big Ma parked the wagon in front of the building where four shingles hung from the rusted post. One of the shingles read, "Wade W. Jameson, attorney at law."
"Mr. Jameson lives here?" I cried, scrambling down. "I want to see him."
"He don't live here," said Big Ma, opening a large purse. She pulled out a large manila envelope, checked inside, then gingerly put it back again.
"This here's his office, and I got some business with him. You get on back in the wagon."
Big Ma climbed down, and I didn't get back in.
"Can I just go up and say hey?" I persisted.
"I'm going to hey you," Big Ma said. "You keep pestering me." She glanced over at Stacy and TJ.
"Y'all wait here for me, and I'll soon get back.
We'll go to that shop and so we can get on home before it gets dark."
When she had gone inside, TJ said, "What you going to see that old white man for anyway, Cassie? What you and him got to talk about?"
"I just wanted to see him, that's all," I said, going to the raised sidewalk and taking a seat.
"I liked Mr. Jameson, and I didn't mind admitting it. He came to see us several times a year, mainly on business, and although the boys and I were somewhat shy of him, we were always glad to see him. He was the only white man I had ever heard address Mama and Big Ma as Mrs.
and I liked him for that. Besides that, in his own way, he was like Papa. Asked him a question, he would give it straight with none of his pussyfooting around business. I liked that. After several minutes of watching farmers in faded overalls and their women in flower sack cut dresses promenading under the veranda, TJ said, "Why don't we go on down to the Mercantile and look around?" Stacy hesitated. "I don't know. I think Ma, Big Ma, wanted us to go with us. "Oh, shoot, man. We'll be doing her a favor. We go on down to the Mercantile now and order up our stuff. We'll save her some time and so that she can come from seeing that lawyer. We can just go on home. Besides, I got something to show you." Stacy pondered the suggestion for a long moment. "Well, I guess it'll be all right," she said finally. "Big Ma said stay here," I objected, hoping that Mr. Jameson would come out with Big Ma. "Stay here then," Stacy called over his shoulder as he crossed the street with TJ. I dashed after them. I wasn't about to stay on that sidewalk by myself. The Barnett Mercantile had everything. Its shelves, counters, and floor space boasted items from ladies' ribbons to burlap bags of seeds, from babies' bottles to brand-new pot-bellied stoves. TJ, who had been in the store several times before, wove his way among the farmers and led us to a counter at the far corner of the room. The counter had a glass top, and beneath the glass were handguns artfully displayed on a bolt of red velvet. "Just look at him," TJ said dreamily. "Ain't she something?" "What?" I said. "That pearl-handled one. Stacy, man, you ever seen a gun like that before in your whole life? I'd sell my life for that gun. One of these days I'm going to have it, too." "I reckon I ain't," said Stacy politely. "It's a nice-looking gun, all right." I stared down at the gun. A price of $35.95 stared back at me. $35.95? I almost screamed. "Just for an old gun? What the devil are you going to use it for? Can't hunt with it." TJ looked at me with disgust. "Ain't supposed to hunt with it. It's for protection." "Protection of what?" I asked, thinking of Papa's sturdy shotgun that hung over his and Mama's bed, and the sleek Winchester rifle, which Big Ma kept locked in the trunk beneath our own bed. That thing couldn't hardly kill a rattlesnake. "There's other things a body needs protecting from." "More than a rattlesnake," he said haughtily. "I'll get me in that gun, and ain't nobody going to mess with me. I wouldn't need nobody." Stacy backed away from the counter. He seemed nervous being in the store. "We better get those things you need and get on out of here before Big Ma comes looking for us." "Aw, man, there's plenty of time," said TJ, looking longingly at the gun. "Sure wish I'd just hold it just once." "Come on, TJ," ordered Stacy, "or me and Cassie's going to go on back outside." "Oh, all right." TJ turned reluctantly away and went to a counter where a man was measuring nails onto a scale. We stood patiently waiting behind the people in front of us, and when our turn came, TJ handed his list to the man. "Mr. Barrett, sir," he said, "I got me this here list of things my mama wants." The storekeeper studied the list and, without looking up, asked, "You one of Mr. Granger's people?" "Yes, sir," answered TJ. Mr. Barnett walked to another counter and began filling the order. But before he finished, a white woman called, "Mr. Barnett, you waiting on anybody just now?" Mr. Barnett turned around. "Just them," he said, indicating us with a wave of his hand. "What can I do you for, Miss Emmeline?" The woman handed him a list twice as long as TJ's, and the storekeeper, without a word of apology to us, proceeded to fill it. "What's he doing?" I objected. "Hush, Cassie," said Stacy, looking very embarrassed and uncomfortable.
TJ's face was totally bland, as if nothing at all had happened. When the woman's order was finally filled, Mr. Barnett again picked up TJ's list. Before he had gotten the next item, his wife called. "Jim Lee, these folks needing help over here, and I got my hands full." As if he were not even here, if we were not even there, he walked away. "Where's he going?" I cried. "He'll be back," said TJ, wandering away. After waiting several minutes for Mr. Barnett's return, Stacy said, "Come on, Cassie, let's go." We started towards the door, and I followed. But as we passed one of the counters, I spied Mr. Barnett wrapping an order of pork chops for a white girl. Adults were one thing. I could almost understand that. They ruled things, and there was nothing that could be done about that. But some kid who was no bigger than me was something else again. Certainly Mr. Barnett had simply forgotten about TJ's order. I decided to remind him, and without saying anything to Stacy, I turned around and marched over to Mr. Barnett. "Excuse me, Mr. Barnett," I said as politely as I could, waiting a moment for him to look up from his wrapping. "I think you forgot, but you was waiting on us before you was waiting on this girl here, and we've been waiting for a good while now for you to get back." The girl gazed at me strangely, but Mr. Barnett did not look up. I assumed he had not heard me. I was near the end of the counter, so I merely went to the other side of it and tugged on his shirt sleeve to get his attention. He recoiled as though I had struck him. "You was helping us," I said, backing in front of the counter again. "Well, you just get your little black self back over there and wait some more," he said in a low, tight voice. I was hot. I had been as nice as I could be to him, and here he was talking like this. "We've been waiting on you for near an hour," I hissed, "while you round here waiting on everybody else. And it ain't fair. You got no right." "Whose little child, black child, is this?" bellowed Mr. Barnett. Everyone in the store turned and stared at me. "I ain't nobody's little black child," I screamed, angry and humiliated. "And you ought not to be waiting on everybody before you wait on us." "Hush up, child, hush up," someone whispered behind me. I looked around. A woman who had occupied the wagon next to ours was at the market, looked down upon me. Mr. Barnett, his face red and his eyes bulging, immediately pounced on her. "This gal yourn, Hazel?" "No, sir," answered the woman meekly, stepping hastily away to show she had nothing to do with me. As I watched her turn her back on me, Stacy emerged and took my hand. "Come on, Cassie, let's get out of here." "Stacy," I exclaimed, relieved to see him by my side. "Tell him. You know he ain't fair making us wait." "She your sister, boy?" Mr. Barnett spat across the counter. Stacy bit his lower lip and gazed into Barnett's eyes. "Yes, sir." "Then you get her out of here," he said with hateful force, "and make sure she don't come back till your mama teach her what she is." "I already know what I am," I retaliated, "but I bet you don't know what you are, and I could sure tell you too, old yowl." Stacy jerked me forward, crushing my hand in the effort, and whispered angrily, "Shut up, Cassie." His dark eyes flashed malevolently as he pushed me in front of him throughout the crowd. As soon as we were outside, I whipped my hand from his. "What's the matter with you? You know he was wrong." Stacy swallowed to flush his anger, then said gruffly, "I know it was. And you know it, but he don't know it, and that's where the trouble is. Now come on before you get us into a real mess. I'm going up to Mr. Jameson's to see what's keeping Big Ma." "What about TJ?" I called as he stepped in the street. Stacy laughed wryly. "Don't worry about TJ. He knows exactly how to act.
He crossed the street solemnly, and his hands jammed in his pockets. I watched him go, but did not follow. Instead, I ambled along the sidewalk, trying to understand why Mr. Barnett had acted the way he had. More than once I stopped and gazed over my shoulder at the mercantile. I had a good mind to go back and find out what had made Mr. Barnett so mad. I actually turned once and headed towards the store. Then, remembering what Mr. Barnett had said about my returning, I swung back around, kicking at the sidewalk, my head bowed. It was then that I bumped into Lillian Jean Sims. "Why don't you look where you're going?" she said huffily. Jeremy and her younger brothers were with her. "Hey, Cassie," said Jeremy. "Hey, Jeremy," I said solemnly, keeping my eyes on Lillian Jean. "Well, apologize," she ordered. "What? You bumped into me. Now you apologize." I did not feel like messing with Lillian Jean. I had other things on my mind. "Okay," I said, starting past. "I'm sorry." Lillian Jean sidestepped in front of me. "That ain't enough. Get down in the road." I looked up at her. "You crazy? You can't watch where you're going. Get in the road. Maybe that way you won't be bumping into decent white folks with your little nasty self." This second insult of the day was almost more than I could bear. Only the thought of Big Ma up in Mr. Jameson's office saved Lillian Jean's lip. "I ain't nasty," I said, properly holding my temper in check. "And if you're so afraid of getting bumped, walk down there yourself." I started past her again, and again she got my way. "Ah, let her pass, Lillian Jean," said Jeremy. "She ain't done nothing to you." "She done something to me just standing in front of me." And with that, she reached for my arm and attempted to push me off the sidewalk. I braced myself and swept my arm backward out of Lillian Jean's reach. But someone caught it from behind, painfully twisting it, and shoved me off the sidewalk into the road. I landed bottom first on the ground. Mr. Sims glared down at me. "When my gal Lillian Jean says for you to get yourself off the sidewalk, you get, you hear?" And with that line, we're going to have to bring this hour to a close. It's always a pleasure to be with you each Saturday afternoon. This has been Mark Wiesner, and we wish you a great week ahead. Bye-bye. Take care.